session number 22333, reel 12.
By this time you'd gotten your commission, what was it like returning home to Perth and seeing your family again?
Oh, it was a wonderful experience. I mean, we didn't have long back in Perth, that leave. I think they allowed us 5 or 7 days plus the travelling time. And, of course, I was living outside Perth. I was up on my farm. And I immediately went up there, and a funny thing had happened. Whenever I came back on leave, and I could notify my people, I also asked them how my horse was and to get it shot, so that they had some idea that I would be home on leave. Otherwise, I couldn't say, look, I'm coming home on a certain date. I had to just ask them to get my horse that I named Cascade. I asked him how he was and see that his horse shod. And they understood then that I was coming back on leave.
Hmm.
And I came back, and it was I just can't remember. It was just, I remember going out on the farm and riding my horse around, and I don't remember talking very much to the people. I kept out of the town, and I spent the whole time on my farm. And that's how it was. It was me. I just don't remember now. So it was a wonderful experience coming home.
I would assume, and you can correct me, obviously, but it would be quite a bizarre situation to be in relation to having been in this crazy world on the Kokoda track, to come home and be able to ride around the farm on your horse.
Yes. Well, I was lucky. At that stage, I forget now what it. I can't remember, except it was a wonderful experience, and I just can't.
Yeah.
It's just too old, too long ago. I just can't remember. Used to go into the club at night time, in the town, but of course that was thronged with it was an army camp adjoining the town, and. In most cases, my old friends came out to farm and saw me. I didn't worry about going in and seeing them at the club. One or two nights I might have gone in, but on the whole, they'd just come out and spend a short time with me on the farm. And that's how it was, but I just can't remember much about it. It was just a very, very pleasant interlude, if you like to say, between the fighting. That's how it was. Just remarkable.
At this time, what was the sense back home about the situation with regard to the rest of the war?
Oh, there was, the VDC was very, 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 very keen. And all the chaps who were over 30, you might say, and I'm talking about the farm area, not the city. The city was absurd. It was a bit of a panic, I suppose, down in the city. Some people who had money and everything else had sent their children and their wives across to Melbourne. And I remember going into a restaurant and seeing a big poster there big grinning Japanese with a bayonet and a rifle. And I think I might have mentioned this before, so I won't dwell on that. But I can't talk about it. I mean, they weren't panicking. The country wasn't panicking. The city might have been, but up there they were just prepared to get out a gun and a rifle and defend themselves if they had to.
Did people understand what you had been able to achieve at Kokoda, do you think?
Oh, no, they'd never heard of Kokoda. Nobody ever heard about it. They heard of New Guinea. But nobody had a Kokoda or anything like that. They just, there was nothing. The army had never seen it. Once our chaps got home and talked about it, that they really learned about it. Otherwise, there was no censorship was so strong that you couldn't mention anything like that, and the paper just didn't print it. I actually never heard about the bombing of Darwin. till nearly toward the end of the war. Never heard about it. They never talked about it, and we were cut off with all that sort of talk. Mm. We didn't know what went on.
I get the impression that you weren't wanting to talk about your experience to your people.
Oh, no, of course we didn't want, because the thing was that friends, you could. There was the hardest part to meet somebody. People ring up and want to know what happened. Could I tell me anything about so-and-so? And we just shied away from it. We just said, oh, no, sorry. We hadn't seen him for a while or something like that. But they were keen to find out and know how a soldier died, put it that way. And we just wouldn't talk about it. And we shied away from any talk, and we kept away from relatives if possible. I remember one lady who wanted to know about when I came back on leave, wanted to know about the one of my men who got killed, and he kept at me, and I just told her straight out, and I couldn't say I wasn't with him when he died, but actually I was with him when he got killed. Mm. But I wasn't going to tell her that, and how mess it was, he just didn't tell her. It's just we didn't talk about those sort of things. I'm not saying that some soldiers didn't. They might have loved the gory details, but in my case, I was one of the many that didn't want to talk about it. Mm.
I just thought that you might want to talk to your family in a sort of a way of comforting yourself.
No. Never. I'd learned that from the returned men from the First World War. They never talked about it. And they didn't want to talk about it either. They knew very well. They used to mention to me that so-and-so casualty list had come out for the chaps in the Middle East, and who had survived over there, or not who had survived, who had been killed, or who had been wounded. They used to mention that to me, but otherwise we never talked about that I can remember.
I wanted to discuss your next involvement, which was to go back to New Guinea. I understand.
Yes, we went back and we short time in Brisbane, outside Brisbane, at a training camp there, or movement camp, and then we went back to north of Brisbane again, and up into Tablelands. At that stage, I had been sent, or before I'd got back into there, I'd been sent with three others to an amphib training school north of Newcastle in New South Wales with the Americans who had come back from the Gota Canal. They were the old Marine type of soldier. When I say the old tin, they had not enlisted for war service only. They had been in the Marines for some time before the war. They were very highly trained, what I saw them, and they are very, very high, fine body of men. The only trouble was, in a lot of cases, I couldn't understand what they're saying. Because you might meet a soldier in a group from Northeast America, another one from the West Coast, another one from the Deep South. And they all had different accents to, say, a New Yorker, and you had trouble understanding their speech. We didn't have any trouble understanding their friendship. They were a wonderful lot of men. Mm. They were the typical Marine, American Marine. I think they called them Leatherheads or something like that, I don't know. But they were typical. They'd fought in Gota Canal. They'd had experience of fighting over there. They'd suffered heavily. And then they'd come back to an amphibian training there. We joined them for the amphib training. But the thing was, there again, when we moved into a camp, we had a few tents. They moved into a camp and they immediately put up lovely quarters of plywood and they didn't have tents. They had the plywood living billets, and they had big signs up, dental, whatever it was, another sign up for chiropodist for feet, and they had all these signs around the camp, And when you went to mess, you had ice cream, you had everything you could think of. They used to bake their own bread, churn out their ice cream, and the food was something that we never knew it existed. It was so good. And that was the conditions they lived in.
How do you think that this treatment made them more efficient soldiers?
Well, they were used to that treatment. You might have read and heard about it. And we saw it ourselves, that when we landed later on, I'm jumping ahead, when we landed from the plane at Nadsab, where the Americans had been there, established an aerodrome, a few days ahead of us, only a few days, they had ice cream containers, they had everything you could think of. You went there and you could get an ice cream with no trouble at all. They had their full bakeries. They had kitchens that you, like you'd find in it, or better than you'd find any camp in Australia.
What did the Australian High Command then sort of take note and learn from the Americans, that maybe it was a good way to treat their troops as well?
Not the slightest. At the end of the war, we're still having bully beef and biscuits. And that is how we are treated right through. On the last show, we were issued with American rations. In that American rations, you got a container, it was about 10 or 12 inches long and oblong. And in that, you opened it up and you found three meals. You found breakfast, lunch, and evening meal. And in the breakfast, you had dry cereals mixed with water and a little packet of powdered milk. And then you went the whole through that, and there were raisins, there's little bits of dried fig and all those sort of things in each meal you had. And that was the American field day ration. They were given that ration when they went into action. They weren't given like we were, a packet of biscuits in a bit of paper and a tin of bully beef.
How did this make you feel when you saw the Americans getting such treatment towards your officers and towards your situation?
The officers had the same as we did when they went into the field. They didn't have anything different. They weren't like the British officers.
But what of your treatment?
Well, they saw what we got, but we just took it as a way of life. Mm. We knew the Yanks were getting it. And that was a way when we struck, when it landed Maratai, where it was the same there. We saw what the condition the Americans were living under. And when he got into an American ship to go to Balikpapan, we were served half a chicken, a lovely half-roasted chicken, hot, for our evening meal. And we just couldn't believe it, how the Americans, but the way the Americans did it. They were paid, I don't know, about 10 times as much as we were. And they were, that's how they lived. You just can't describe it. I can't anyhow.
You were to be involved with the Markham and Ramu Valley operations. Can you tell us a little bit about them and what their purpose was in relation to, as I understand, their involvement with the Leigh and Finchhaven operations?
Yes. Now, did I mention about going on a trip by ship to Sydney? Well, when we came back, when he came back on leave, some of the men used to come back in cattle trucks. They weren't always in carriages. They were in cattle trucks. Well, they weren't, no, they weren't, I shouldn't say that, they weren't cattle trucks. They were closed-in trucks that you'd been used to transport baggage and things until in peacetime. And they brought back in those for their leave. They detrained at Parkeston, the other side of Kalgoorlie, and fed there. Or we detrained on the way across. They set up at night time, the train would stop, and there'd be a field kitchen alongside the track with a few tents at Cook or somewhere like that. And they would have their food, stew, and things like that on the way back. Well, now, when we came back and we waited to the train, in those days, a lot of ship troops moving backwards and forwards over the Nullarbor, regarded as more important than we were, because they were coming over here to defend our west coast. And they got movement before we did. We went down back to camp one morning. I'd left my car in St George's Terrace in Perth, or was it my utility, farm utility, in St George's Terrace in Perth. And I moved out, expecting to no train that day. I moved, and I would be going back in the morning to pick up my utility again. As soon as we arrived down at the showgrounds, a man I knew came up and said, "Oh, you're off, Jim." And I said, "Oh, there's no train going. How am I off?" He said, "No, you're going by ship." So we went down to Fremantle, got on the ship there, a beautiful big ship, the Dominion Monarch. We arrived off Sydney, and I thought I'd mentioned this before, and we didn't know why, but we suddenly turned round and went out to sea at a fast speed.
Yes, you
did. And it was the Minchin submarines coming into Sydney Harbour.
Mm.
Well, now, Sydney was in a panic. There's no doubt about the whole city was in a panic. Anyhow, we stayed there a few days, then went back and joined the troops, joined the battalion on the Tablelands.
Yeah.
And there we trained very, very hard for the next show. And that was turned out to be, we didn't know at the time, but turned out the Rhyme and Markham show.
Right.
At that stage, we were driving the Japs back. We had driven back onto the coast and from Wau and Lae. And we had troops going up. The Americans mostly withdrawn. There were just a very few Americans, I believe, down with them. The militia 9th Divi, the 6th Divi. And they moved up the coast. We went back and we were inland and did the Rhyme and Markham show. We had no idea what was going on. We didn't know anything about it. All we knew was that at Moresby, we were training there in route marching, that's all. Just no other train. We'd done our training back in Australia. We're just getting fit with route marching. And suddenly we were told that we were going to cut our kit down to bare minimum and leave our kit bags, everything behind, just packs with a minimum of clothing in it. And we guessed there was something on, that we must be flying. And then while we were at Moresby, we heard about the 21st Brigade moving out, and they flew out to a place we call Nadzeb. We'd heard about Nadzeb because a parachute battalion had landed there, American parachute battalion had landed there, and our parachute battalion with some artillery units of the Australian Army. They had landed at Nadzeb. We were going. And for 2 or 3 days, it was delayed because of the weather. And then we got ordered to move, and we prepared to move. And the night before we moved, we had camped there, and we heard this terrific explosion close by. And unfortunately, a Liberator had been taken off with a full load of bombs, and it had crashed into a sister battalion of the 25th. C Company, and just about wiped out the whole company. C Company was just about wiped out. And we saw planed next morning, we saw all the remains being cleaned up. And that gave us some idea what could happen to the, when I say some idea, to our men who had not seen battle before, it gave them some idea what it could be like. Anyhow, we went across, landed in Nadzeb, and that's where I first saw the Americans with their ice cream set up and their food. And we landed in Nadzeb, and I was with a Ford company, and we were sent out straight away on a very, very tiring march to try and cut the Japs off. They had been defeated in Lae and were supposed to be moving up inland. We got out there, it was too late, they'd already passed on the track. So then we turned around and came back and joined the rest of the battalion at Nadjab. Now, at Nadjab, while we were waiting there, we saw these planes coming down, and these are the American planes, wonderful flyers with what the DC-3 Douglas are known as. But the American pilots were wonderful, we thought. They were wonderful men. And we all came to go up with them because we knew they were the best.
Mm.
And they used to have our jokes with us, like when we were going over to Nadjab. One of them turned around and asked if any of our chaps had a map. And when we inquired why, what do you want a map for, he told us he was lost and didn't have a clue. And he wanted us to help him out. Well, we were flying up in the clouds then, and we didn't have a clue, because that's the sort of joke he pulled on us, that he was lost and he didn't know where to go. Actually, later on, at the top of the Raymond Markham show, and when some of our men came up, came up by plane, they told us then that these pilots had worked so hard and so tired that they had actually overflown the strip where they should have landed and were flying over to the coast where all the Japs were. They were that tired and worn out because they'd been out so long. Now,
you were going to talk about the Markham and Ramu operations. Can you tell us what that involved?
Well, I was saying at Nadjab we went back and we camped there. Then we moved down towards Lay, and we, at that stage we didn't know that the 25th Battalion, or the 25th Brigade, had got into Lay before the 9th Divy, who had done an amphib landing north of Lay and been delayed by the Japs and getting across a large river. And this 25th had got into Lay. They'd been shelled by the artillery with the 9th Divy and had to withdraw. The 9th Divy claimed, of course, they got into Lay first. Our 7th Divy claimed that we got into Lay first, so it never decided. Anyhow, on that down there, I remember the first day going down towards Lay, we camped on the side of a road and stopped on the side of the road to have our meal, midday meal. And we're lying under these coconut trees, and without warning, a coconut fell down and hit the ankle of the man alongside me. It didn't break his ankle, but it badly hurt it, sprained it, and he then went back to Moresby, the hospital. It was the first time I've heard these jokes about coconuts being falling from trees, but the first time I'd ever heard it, and only time I ever heard it happen, saw it happen. But this cove paid no further. I don't think he ever returned to our battalion, if I remember rightly. His ankle was that badly damaged that he was invalid at home, I think. But after that, we returned to Nadjab, and we saw these planes coming down with the wounded from the Kaipit, about 100 miles north, where the commandos had been landed there, and the Japs had attacked them. The Japs that we had tried to stop going around when he first got to Nadjab, they'd circled there and got to Kaipit and attacked the commandos or the independent company. The independent company had killed 120 of them. And there was a bit of a panic because the division thought that the Japs might hold a little airfield there. So they sent our Don Company up by plane straight away from Nadjab to reinforce the independent company. The battalion followed the next day, and we landed at the Kaipit, and there we saw the dead Japs still lying there on the ground where they'd been killed. And of course in those days you didn't stop to bury a dead Jap, you just went on, and that was it. But there again, these swollen bodies had gave our recruits, our reinforcements, quite a start, quite a shock, I think. to see them just lying there. Anyhow, we from Kaiapit on, we started to move up to the Army of Markham show, knowing that the chaps were all the way up there, they were there, and we advanced up there, and not knowing all the time that the chaps had bypassed the track that we were on and gone up near the coast and arrived up further. And they had been engaging with the commandos several times the way up. But we didn't encounter them till we got what they call the Yumai River, when you cross the Yumai River. So that's when the first time we encountered them.
What was that situation?
Well, we crossed the... My platoon had to... I was in the pioneer platoon then. I'd been tested as a pioneer platoon. And our job was to get the battalion across the Yumai River. It was flowing very, very quickly. It was wide. And... eventually we got the whole battalion across by using ropes, and of course they got wet. We lost one man, or we actually never lost him. He went downstream and some natives found him later on, and he recovered and came back and joined the battalion. But we got right across the river, and we were across there. We stayed on both sides, my platoon, and much to the disgust of our CO and the disgust of the whole battalion, we suddenly got orders to withdraw and to about 20 miles from the river. And so the whole battalion had to come back across the river, back to about 20 miles camp. We stayed at the river, holding the position there where we had the crossing, and we were joined that night, in the middle of the night, by an independent company that came down and joined us. It gave us a shock when they came down, because we didn't know they were joining us, and there was nearly a lot of trouble there, but luckily our troops were very well trained, and there was no engagement. Over the river we'd left two standing patrols, two platoons, and they were both engaged that night. They suffered some, no deaths, but they suffered some wounds. But that's the first time we struck the Japs in.
What sort of situation were they in at this point? Were they fighting strongly?
We didn't know. We didn't have a clue. All that happened was that we'd strike them with a certain platoon in the battalion, before platoons or flanking platoons. We'd strike them and they'd withdraw. We'd drive them back. We understood that they were just forces out looking for patrols, looking for us. But they knew that they were withdrawing, and they were withdrawing to their positions up at the top of the Markham River, Ramu River, up in the hills there, the mountains there, where they dug in and held, knew they were going to take a lot of digging out.
This would, I assume, have then led you to Shaggy Ridge.
Well, we went up, I can't remember the name of the river, Faria, I think it was, F-A-R-I-A.
Yep.
And there was a camp there. We formed a camp there. And then the 2nd, 27th had moved up on before us, on the right. They went up onto a ridge out from Saggy Ridge. I've even forgotten the name of the ridge now. And there the Japs had attacked them. And they'd killed 69. It had a few wounded and killed themselves, but it killed 69 dead counter Japs. We know that because we relieved them a day later and took over that position, and the Japs were there to be buried. And that's how we knew about it.
Mm.
And we stayed there, patrolled out there, had encountered the Japs, and lost some men killed and some men wounded. We were more or less, didn't know what was going on. We were patrolling or feeling our way all the time to see where the Japs positions were. But we never attacked them to a strong position. We only attacked their outposts. They had the mountain gun there and they were shelling us, and But we never put an attack there at all. We just, except that we attacked the outposts. They never attacked us.
Did you understand the importance of the position Shaggy Ridge and their holding of it?
No. We didn't understand anything. We were just there to do a job, and we just did the job. We knew our whole brigade was there, the 2nd 14th. We knew that the artillery. When we came, we were drawn back towards Shaggy Ridge one day. I sent out to protect some artillery unit that had been, the Japs had been attacked the night before, and I sent out to reinforce them. They're more or less on the foothills, the Japs stayed up in the hills. That was the only time that I know of they came down when they attacked the artillery crowd.